your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Sunday morning wake-up call. Here we go, boys and girls. This should be a rowdy show as we talk politics just 2 days before the presidential election here in the United States. Let me take a moment and thank those folks out in Lovingston on 94.7 for listening with us today, and Alt Energy for their support here on WNRN. It's Alt Energy of Charlottesville, providing professional design and installation of solar energy systems in Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Alt Energy solar systems can pay for themselves and reduce your carbon footprint. More can be found at AltEnergyIncorporated.com. That's one long string of things, AltEnergyIncorporated.com. And yes, I am your host, Rick Moore, but I am your injured host, thanks to somebody who went tunneling at the University of Virginia on Friday night Halloween. I was walking across the lawn on the sidewalk the other day and flipped over a manhole cover and dropped down and cracked a knee and otherwise injured. So anybody who would like to get in with a lawsuit on the University of Virginia, please let me know. We can all make millions of dollars together and split the funds. All right, let's introduce the guest for today. Rusty said he was having weird problems with the board, so let's make sure everybody is fired up and ready to go. Let's see. We'll start with Pete Ronayne. We'll go in alphabetical order. Pete, how are you?
Good morning, Rick. Pleasure to be here, as always.
And thank you for joining me. I think you're excited about today's program, are you not?
Very excited. There's tons to talk about as we careen towards Tuesday.
Careen. That's a good word for that. Almost Katrina-like. and we have Jim Sofka with us as well. Jim?
Good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much.
Sorry to hear about the knee.
I think I'll live, but it doesn't mean that I won't file a lawsuit. I am a good American. Isn't that what helps make a good American? Trying to live off free money from other people. All right. Pete Ronayne, Jim Sofka, both invited as today's guests because of affiliations with the University of Virginia, adjunct professors, former professors, current professors.
All of the above.
All of the above. Authors. Both currently working at the Federal Executive Institute, that sort of hidden building up on 29 around the Berks Road area.
You know, we could do a show on that alone someday.
Could we?
Happy to do that.
Can you actually tell? Can you actually tell people what goes on there?
I could.
Yeah.
It could provide a great public service just talking about that alone.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who actually notice it would be quite interested as to why they can't block the driveway alone when there's a lot going on in the traffic on 29.
Yeah. It's just common courtesy.
And you are political, historical, governmental experts.
Yes, I would say we bring a very interdisciplinary approach to analysis of contemporary events.
Excellent. Good way to put it.
That's giving yourselves a big pat on the back, is it not?
Well, we do that on occasion.
All right. So let's just jump right into things. 979-0919 is the phone number for today. That's the local number, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks. For those of you who are voting and interested in the outer regions, Harrisonburg, Lexington, Lynchburg, Richmond, Lovingston, for whom it may not be a local call, 979-0919.
And we expect a lot of calls, as we were saying back there. Everybody's got that extra hour of sleep fired up, so...
Extra hour of coffee under the belt.
We're looking forward to it.
I just used it to sleep. No coffee for me. All right, so Pete Ronayne, Jim Sofka here in the studio. Let's just jump right into it. Everything has been discussed, I would think. This has been going on for almost 2 years, I would say.
Seems like 400, yeah.
It seems that
Obama announced 21 months ago.
Exactly. 21 months ago that this has been ongoing. I had someone ask me why this has been going on for so long, and it's because we do not have an incumbent president. And the vice president has made it clear 21 months ago that he would not be attempting to run for president. Mm-hmm. So for this, pretty much for 4 years, we've been trying to define who the candidates would be and put them in the position of winning their primary races and stepping forward to be a one-on-one issue.
Yeah, it's the first year since 56 years since this situation has developed.
What, since Eisenhower or Stevenson?
52, yeah.
Yeah, which is remarkable to have no incumbent of any sort, a vice president as incumbent or a sitting president. Yep. And that has certainly influenced this dynamic and opened up possibilities that, in fact, are coming to pass that one could not even have imagined even just 21 months ago.
And now we've done nothing for the last month except wait for the big mistake to be made and read about the polls.
And when you say the we, that's exactly right, Rick. In fact, the numbers are staggering when you look at the attention that Americans are paying to this election, the number of Americans, not just anecdotally, but in actual quantitative surveys who argue they are paying a significant amount of attention to this election. It's amazing how galvanizing in terms of attention and eyeballs and creating political junkies out of Americans who had never been before.
And is this really boiled down to the fact that that there is no incumbent running for office? A lot of people have said, well, this is really the swing in the future of where the United States goes. Is that really what has drawn so many people into paying attention?
Well, it's part of it. I mean, it certainly started the process earlier. The fact that there was no incumbent, that there was no clear front runner in either party got everybody going earlier, and that's one of the reasons why we've been in this cycle for so long. But I think at this point, the reason why there's so much attention is because of the situation facing the country in the largest possible sense economically. And that's got a lot of people focused on their futures, their personal financial situation. When those 401k statements got sent around after the recent stock market debacle, it's got people engaged politically, and that's the issue. I mean, in 2004, it was terrorism, the war in Iraq just starting up, but since then, it's the economy. So people feel this personally. They pay it at the they pay higher prices at the gas pump, although that's beginning to decline a bit. And it's got people on top of that matrix of an early and very vigorous political campaigning season. When you've got people who feel that this situation that the country is facing economically is affecting them personally, that's what's got them engaged, because the solutions to these problems are going to affect them at the most material level.
I think, too, Rick, that the nature of the two candidates as well. I mean, that sort of goes without saying, but once we got out of the primaries, once Obama emerged as the Democratic standard bearer, a clear sense that we are moving away from the Clinton and Bush years. It's not just about the Bush years, but it's been a long time with either a Bush or Clinton in the White House, either as president or vice president. And I think that was really galvanizing and attention-grabbing for people, that we're going to have a change of cast here. We're going to have very different individuals, and then we have two candidates emerged who are quite different in many ways besides ideology. It was one of the most classic examples of change versus continuity in terms of American politics. You could argue that Bush and Kerry and Bush and Gore and some elections prior to that, obviously they had differences, some more striking than others, but they weren't as dramatically different, I would argue, as the two candidates that we have right now in terms of personality, in terms of background, in terms of generation, in terms of demographics. I mean, on so many levels. So this is a fundamental election about change and continuity, whichever side, and both have merits. Both are very important, and I think that's why people are so engaged, are so emotional on both sides, are so fired up on both sides, because change is challenging, and it's more than just a political slogan. And there is change at stake here either way.
But you talk about change, and is it just the Obama campaign's effort and success and putting so many people at unease by saying that McCain is really just another 4 years of Bush? And so there's really only one side of this, only one of the candidacies that says, yes, this is change. Right. And when you say that McCain would be a change, how much of a change is it?
Well, that's where campaigns become very important. That is how you actually run and execute the strategy to get to the White House. And McCain has been very slow to talk about what change means for him. He's actually let Obama he's almost ceded the word change to the Obama campaign. And a lot of Republicans have been bothered by that. because it's tough for him. It would be difficult for any member of either party to fight after 8 years of an unpopular president. That's a sort of millstone around anyone's neck. But if McCain had come out earlier about, this is where I'm going to change, this is how the next 4 years or 8 years are going to look different specifically, then I think we'd be in a different ballgame. But McCain really took a long while to decide, was he going to sort of present himself as the moderate change agent from the Bush years, sort of tweak around the edges the things that is particularly with foreign policy that Bush did that he didn't like? Or is he going to be a radical new thinker? That's what you've gotten now, the McCain sort of 2.0, which has been the last couple of weeks, the Joe the Plumber, John McCain. I'm going to, you know, re-engineer the economy. That's only been in the past 3 or 4 weeks. Obama's been on this theme presciently for the past 21 months.
Yes, where has the maverick been? Because he used to be, and I think even he would state, that he was the maverick. And I had someone remind me that, or sort of in their own opinion, that he sold out when he went down to Liberty University and did a speech for and with Jerry Falwell, and the maverick disappeared. And now he has, at some point fairly recently, attempted to return. And again, I am fighting so hard not to be one-sided in our hour here. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. But while we are discussing McCain, and Jim Sofgut here from Federal Executive Institute with Pete Ronayne, Jim, you said McCain 2.0 just in the last few weeks. Where did the maverick go, and why is it now just returning?
Well, I mean, this maverick idea, it's hard to be a maverick when you have to deal and respond to the entrenched financial and political interests that McCain has to. That's why he went to Liberty University, because he had to shore up those red states. He has to get the base energized. And the selection of Palin was not a maverick move. The selection of Joe Lieberman or Tom Ridge, which is what he really wanted to do, would have been a maverick move. But he was too concerned about getting away from the Republican base if he had a pro-choice vice president. His situation in Pennsylvania would be enhanced. I'm not saying he would win it, but it would be enhanced if he had the former governor of Pennsylvania, Tom Ridge, very popular, on his ticket. Palin represented an appeal to a very traditional Republican constituency, albeit in a different gender, much younger, and in a little bit sassier form. On basic fundamental principles, though, she's not that different than a lot of Republican, and embodies a lot of Republican positions, since really a streak that's grown out of the Goldwater candidacy of 1964. So McCain has been sort of saddled with this problem. He's not the McCain of 2000, where he really was a maverick, where he stood up against what he called agents of intolerance in South Carolina. He's become actually much more conservative. Conservative with a small c, in the sense of being careful in his campaign, and instead of following his instincts, he's followed a more scripted plan that I don't think has always been to his benefit. And when you get the maverick, it came out in odd phases, like when he said, I'm going to suspend my campaign and run back to D.C. to talk about the economy. There you see sort of the fighter pilot John McCain, the rapid decision. But it didn't translate into any kind of strategic goal, because he can only go so far from that Republican orthodoxy.
And I think we have to remind ourselves also that the maverick lost in 2000. I mean, it's a very carefully crafted persona. But McCain, like Obama, like everybody who's run, they are political animals. And the maverick lost in 2000. So he has moved towards a more decidedly Karl Rove strategy of firing up the base, which Jim just mentioned. And he's had to walk, you know, in John McCain's defense, he's had to walk a very delicate tightrope given the sitting president, who is the you know, titular head of this party, who he has pledged some loyalty to, and which some conservatives still, you know, support fairly strongly. Now, of course, over time, that's declined as the president's approval rating has declined across the board. But that was a difficult for this candidate to sort of straddle those lines, to talk about change and still be loyal to the sitting president, et cetera. So I think he had a unique challenge in that regard. And he opted, and again, we can look in retrospective already, he opted for the fire-up base Karl Rove strategy, which it turns out is simply not going to work out.
And if you look at it, it's a testament to McCain, again, to be fair to him, as Pete suggested, that he's doing as well as he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
By a lot of models political scientists have for elections, this should be an open and shut year. This should be a year that looks like 84 or 72 in the sense of an economy that's going rapidly into recession, an unpopular war, an unpopular sitting president for 8 years. All of these structural forces should have made it to the point where you could run an average house cat as the opposition party and done pretty well. So McCain is doing, you know, formidably against a headwind that would be difficult for any politician, but particularly for someone who's trying to straddle the I'm the independent maverick, making my own decisions, and as Pete suggested, very much the creature of the established Republican Party because it worked well up until 2005.
Yeah, I think the structural factors can't be underestimated in giving McCain credit for hanging as tough as he has. I think, secondly, the McCain campaign and the Hillary Clinton campaign made the same fundamental mistake. It's a mistake, again, in retrospect, but at the time, you have to decide what are one of the pillars of our campaigns going to be? What's one of the thematic, consistent points we want to hit? And they both, at least early on, went with experience. I'm the candidate of experience. And I'll run against this inexperienced candidate of change. That did not work for Hillary Clinton, as it turned out. And she tried to change as she went through, but it was too late to adopt the mantle of change. I think McCain as well. He went for experience early on versus inexperience and youth and change. And he, too, has tried to pivot on that. As it turns out, the national mood is much more in favor of change at this point. I mean, as I mentioned before, if you include Bush Sr.'s years as vice president, and then the Clinton years, and then the current President Bush. That's 32 years of a Bush or a Clinton in the White House. And I think they underestimated 32 years. Yeah.
16, 4,
they
20.
Did the math wrong. 28. Would have been 30. Eight. Could have been 32 if Hillary Clinton won. So that's a long time. And I think people underestimate just not that people are even conscious about it. They're not walking in thinking about that overtly, that, yeah, I don't want, you know, I've done the math and I've seen that it's been, you know, 28 years. But I think viscerally, I think intuitively people have that sense, and it hurt then both of the candidates are more the candidates of experience.
All right, we got a question over the internet, the AOL board, WNRN studio, on the AOL, whatever, send us an IM question if you'd like. And it is, what is the Bradley effect role in the election?
Well, the Bradley
effect. First of all, define the Bradley effect for everybody who doesn't know.
Bradley effect is based on a gubernatorial candidate for governor in California in 1982, Tom Bradley, who was polling extremely well and then did less well than the pre-election polls would have indicated.
And this goes back to 1980-something, right?
1982.
82, yeah.
And the argument is that a lot of particularly white voters who said they were going to vote for him once they go into the voting booth did not vote for him because of issues of race.
So you say that it's okay to vote for him because you don't want to appear as being racist.
Right.
But then when it actually comes down to it and the curtains are drawn and no one can see what you're doing,
you don't vote that way. It's sort of, I don't know, my sense, and I'd be interested to hear Jim's comment, it's a bit of a political unicorn, I think. I mean, it's talked about a lot, but there's not a lot of data or evidence. And so a couple things that I would point out on the Bradley effect, things have changed a lot since 1982. We're seeing that already.
Right, we have a whole generation later, right? It's 25 years.
When we think about the youngest Americans, think about a college student today, think of our colleagues down at UVA. They've known nothing but an African American Secretary of State for all of their sort of political years.
That's those born in Virginia, an African American governor.
Yeah, it's remarkable. So the demographics of the country have changed. Attitudes about race have changed. I would argue, we were talking about this offline earlier, that what we might actually witness is a reverse of the Bradley effect. In fact, the governor of North Carolina was talking about this, about maybe more rural whites. He was talking about Appalachian whites, et cetera, who, you know, might be subject to the Bradley effect. But in his view, in his sort of anecdotal polling, you'll have a lot of, in this case, white Americans who might not be willing to say they will vote for Obama, But they will when they go into the
because
the
of their polls. Neighbors.
Yeah, whatever.
They don't want the neighbors to think that they might or are afraid of.
Sure.
They're afraid that others might find out that they're going to vote for the African American guy.
Whatever the discomfort is, they don't want to admit it publicly or on a poll or even to their friends. But when push comes to shove, in large part because, as Jim mentioned, the October surprise. We did have an October surprise, and it's the economy. And if you go back to the Clinton Carville mantra that it's the economy, stupid. And the fact, lots of things that play into this. We have an African-American candidate, a mixed-race descent candidate, who is not an identity candidate. Obama has not run as a black candidate in the way that a more traditional baby boomer African-American candidates have. That is a striking difference and has made him more appealing and more palatable, if you will, to a much broader spectrum of the voter. So, exactly. For all those reasons, I think the reverse Bradley effect is quite not just possible, but likely.
Yeah, Pete's absolutely right. And that discussion of a political unicorn is certainly apt, because the only other case since 82 in California where the Bradley effect or something like it was witnessed was right here in the Commonwealth in 1989 when Doug Wilder ran for governor. Polling data showed that he was ahead by, I believe it was about 13 points, and he won by a whisker. He won that race, unlike Tom Bradley, who was up by 7 and then lost in 82. But data and polling data that was done afterwards, and Doug Wilder himself in subsequent interviews and even in recent discussions that he's had, have talked about the Bradley effect having some impact on that 89 race. But again, that was a long time ago. And where most observers seem to think that the Bradley effect or something like it would take place is not where you would think in the South. That if it does take place, it would be in Pennsylvania, Ohio, perhaps West Virginia. But right now, it's tough to measure, because you can't measure something like the Bradley effect except in hindsight, because the whole idea of it is that people will not identify their preferences in any kind of polling. My own judgment is it's not going to matter much in this election. I do think it's been 20, 25 years of rapidly changing political electorate in the country. And also, as Pete suggested, Obama is a different breed of cat than previous African-American politicians, because he hasn't used race in any kind of clear way in his campaign in terms of identity. And so I certainly would see it as possible and wouldn't rule it out, as much as my better instincts would like to think that we're completely beyond it. But I don't think it's going to swing this election in any significant way.
I think a further factor is the extent and the fine-tuning of polling nowadays. It is a lot more sophisticated now. We have a lot more polls that we can then merge into a mega poll. So, I mean, our ability to more effectively poll people between now and 1982 has grown significantly as well. So
it's more accurate.
I think overall, if you aggregate all of the polling data that we have, it's a much more accurate snapshot.
And there are more places that poll rather than being dependent on one or two.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's not just the Gallup poll or what's the other one, the Roper poll.
That's right. You have so many organizations that are doing this and fine tuning it. So I'd be surprised to see that type of electoral surprise on Tuesday night.
All right, 11:21 here on the Wake Up Call. Thank you for the question over the internet. Mm-hmm. Instant message. Dial us up if you'd like. If you're afraid of having your voice heard on the radio because of the Bradley effect or anything else, pass your question along to Deepak. He'll bring it on in. 979-0919 1-877-WNRN Rocks. Jim Sofka and Pete Ronayne, former, current, past, future folks at the UVA professorship. Federal Executive Institute, authors, academics on the current presidential election. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Pretty nice today. Sunshine out there. Highs 55 to 60. Mostly cloudy with some light rain possible tonight. Lows 40 to 45. Partly cloudy and then clearing tomorrow. Highs 60 to 65 right now. Some sun all over our listening area. 59 in the Valley, 59 in Lynchburg, 61 in Richmond, and a lovely 58 here in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, and let's thank 45fix.com for supporting WNRN today. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate, no obligation estimates are available anytime. That's 45fix.com, the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And we also want to remind those of you who made pledges to the recently completed fund drive but haven't paid them, please do so as soon as possible. People can take your payment and help you with your premiums here at the station until 7 p.m. on weekdays, often later, and on the weekends as well. If you call first, we're at 2250 Old Ivy Road in Charlottesville, behind the Ivy Inn. The zip code is at 22903 if you're going to mail in your pledge. The second round of written reminders is going out next week. Thanks again to everyone who has already honored their pledge to help us reach over 94% collected on the over $82,000 pledged. All right, back in action here with the smart guys talking about the upcoming election just on Tuesday. All right, we already tossed out a few things about key states and stuff, and we'll get back to that in a minute. I want to talk about the word October was mentioned as to things happening in October to potentially change things. Key things that I've seen, and I want to talk about all of them. Obama's infomercial from the other night, and I was like, wow, that seems to me that that's a big gamble as to whether or not you were going to make people upset, take away their TV time, possibly say something. And I'm sure that it was well scripted was the word that we've already used today as well. It was well scripted and, you know, watched by hundreds and dozens of people to make sure that it was just what they wanted to say, sort of like a movie that gets checked out before it's released to see exactly when people laugh and when people cry and so on. But was or was that not a gamble?
It was a gamble in that it involved possibly changing Game 6 of the World Series and postponing it. And that's something that, you know, you don't do at the end of October is mess with the World Series. You're right, Rick. I mean, Obama did focus group that, looked at it from various angles. It was expensively produced. It was a montage of a lot of his campaign themes. If you noticed, all of the states from which those Americans came from were carefully chosen. New Mexico, Ohio, Pennsylvania, conveniently all of the states that are very much in play. These weren't people from Massachusetts or New York or California, which Obama doesn't have to worry about. So it was there was a lot of political calculation there. I think, and the results, looking at it in terms of the ratings, were staggering. Obama drew in a huge number of viewers across a wide spectrum of households. I was looking at some of this data, actually, in the New York Times site, that it seemed to have paid off quite well. His viewership went up. Now, we won't know the effect to which that actually was able to swing the election one way or the other. It could be that, to some extent, the audiences Obama was reaching were sort of preaching to the converted. What it showed, regardless, is the amount of money that the Obama campaign has at its disposal this late in the election. That is the staggering fact. That Obama, a week before the election, could afford to buy airtime. And I think that that commercial cost him somewhere in the order at least of $10 million.
Because it was on...
Everybody, except ABC, covered it.
Right. And then there were even some key... I don't know, cable stations.
It was on Univision.
Fox right. News put it on, believe it or not.
Right, it was on BET for the African-American.
BET and Univision.
Voters. It was on Univision for the Hispanic voters. It was on 3 out of 4 major networks.
Yeah, and
probably another channel or two.
Then the money and what that shows is that Obama has cash to ladle around on something that's that expensive, as well as to introduce new commercials. Now, again, this is very late in the campaign to put a new air war into North Dakota, of all places, Georgia, Arizona. These are states that Obama is likely not to win on Tuesday. But the fact that he's willing to invest even 25 cents into these states this late in the election shows a tremendous confidence and is highlighting the money advantage that he has over McCain, who opted for the public financing system.
Well, why would you spend the money there? I mean, if you know that you said not even spend 25 cents, and you know you...
You know you're not going to
misunderstand you. He knows that he's not going to win.
Right.
So why spend the money just to show off your money?
Well, it's more than just showing off the money, and I want to get to that. I will say I think that the infomercial, as it's been described, was perhaps less risky, honestly, and I don't mean this in a funny way, but in an era of DirecTV and cable, et cetera. I mean, people don't want to watch. They have a lot more options.
Is the guy's name Ron Popeil?
I
heard
right.
an NPR interview with Ron Popeil.
Yeah, Ronco.
The guy who interviewed the...
Yep, Ronco.
Right.
Dehydrator and pocket fisherman. And,
right, who does infomercials, and they were talking with him about, you know, the quality of the program.
It was extremely high quality. I mean, if it's any indication of what, if there is a future Obama administration... in terms of theatrics and staging, we already saw some of that at the Democratic convention, but it was first rates. I mean, from amber waves of grain starting off through all of, as Jim mentioned, carefully selected individuals, the staging, sort of a Oval Office-esque background, et cetera. So he has the money. Jim's absolutely right, and it shows that. It shows the power of the Democrats' purse string this time, which... You know, it was a reversal of the usual fortunes, and consistently the GOP outraises and outspends Democrats, so it shows that. But what Jim and I were talking about before, this is a reflection why the money in North Dakota, why money in Arizona, and more money in North Carolina to keep that close. It's because Howard Dean, actually, the failed Democratic candidate from an election before, and who is now the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, he said early on, and this was about infighting in the Democratic Party, he wanted to change the electoral calculation of the Democratic Party. He did not like the strategic approach where you pick and choose, kind of like a reverse containment policy. We've got to hold certain states, and then we're going to reach out to a couple others, but just sort of picking and choosing. He was determined to make the Democratic Party a 50-state party, that we will compete in every state, is what he said.
So are you saying that he's... Even though he may know that he's not going to win, was North Dakota the country that or the country? It is in its own country. It is in its own world almost.
No comments on that. But.
Jim, is that what you said? North Dakota was the state that you mentioned. That it's not so much Obama winning the state as it is helping House of Representatives or governors or whatever.
Helping contemporary candidates, but I think it's even more prospective than that. It's laying the groundwork to be a national party. What Howard Dean has said is, look at what the Republicans have done. They had been very successful at creating grassroots support across the country, that they are a national party. He was very fearful that the Democrats were becoming too focused on existing blue states and not working to expand their base. So one of the success stories of the Obama campaign, supported by Dean's vision, is being a 50-state campaign, having offices all over the place. I mean, this area is a good example. The number of offices, the Nelson County offices and the Southside offices, and, you know, spread out all across Virginia. Whether that pays off this year or in this campaign for an electoral win in all these states isn't entirely the point. It's about laying that foundation so the party becomes, once again, a national party and isn't just picking and choosing certain states.
Yeah, Pete's absolutely right. It is certainly a homage to Dean's strategy of we're going to compete everywhere, which was very unpopular at first in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, let me jump in on that. It was criticized as late as June when the Obama campaign was talking about spending money in Virginia, in Indiana, and North Carolina.
Right.
Now it's paying off in those states, but there was within the party complaints about that, saying, no, you're throwing money down the rabbit hole. It helps to have money, but it's part of a broader strategy. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, and broader than that is that, you know, Obama is demonstrating that he's going to put his money where his mouth is. He's talked about in 2004 at his keynote for Kerry, he said there's no blue states or red states, only the United States. So by putting money into these states, you could dismiss it as lip service, but he's showing, look, I am going to compete in places where I know I'm not going to win just to demonstrate a presence. And the other issue is, prospectively, as Pete put it, is to build a legislative majority in the future. Obama knows that if he does win, and even with a solid Democratic majority picking up 25 to 30 seats in the House and at least 7 Senate seats, possibly 8, the Alaska case is kind of curious with Stevens's conviction. But the issue that Obama's looking at is that we're going to need a broad national economic strategy. The more that I could reach out to people in quote-unquote red America, are folks that I could possibly convert, who are familiar with my arguments. I build a little groundswell of support for me, even if it's not enough to carry the state this time, in order to build a legislative mandate for the future. So it's an investment, and he's got the money to invest, so why not? It really doesn't cost him anything at this point. He's got all of his bases covered, so why not invest a little bit in this? It provides party unity, and it helps possibly Obama, if he wins, in the future to build a legislative mandate for some of his programs.
All right, 11:33 on the wake-up call as we talk with Jim Sofka and Pete Ronayne here in the WNRN studio, talking about Election Day, 2 days away. Please, whatever you do, get out and vote. I don't really even care who you vote for. Kind of not. But one of the things that I am most one of the things that bothers me most is to see 20% or 25% return rate in terms of people who get out there. Let's see something that's much closer to 100%. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. This might get the phones going. This was a question that I was given before coming on air today. It goes out to both of you. Who can still possibly be undecided at this point in the race? I mean, we see that all the time at all three. Or
21 guess, months later.
If you count the vice presidential debates, at four debates, every one of them, they had some group of people who were there, you know, the undecided voters, to see if any of the conversation, any of the debate topics, you know, swung you one way or the other in terms of final decision. And the conversation that we were having was, who can possibly still be undecided?
There's two broad categories of undecided voters. The one are called Sunday paper undecideds. That's today. Those are people who truly sit down on Sunday with the big Sunday election specials, and they read it, and then they make a decision. The last time that this was really had a demonstrated effect was 1980, when Carter was ahead until very late into that election, and suddenly Reagan pulled out. And this was sort of attributed to a late surge in a debate with Reagan, a lot of advertising that Reagan did. So there are those people who truly have tried to put off engaging on this election until today or tomorrow, as opposed to those of us who have been with this, it seems like, since the Civil War, when this began. But most of those undecideds, Rick, are not undecideds, and most pollsters will tell you that. They know who they're going to vote for. They just don't want to tell the pollster.
And I think they want the attention. I swear that my train of thoughts when I see, you know, Katie Couric or whoever, whatever channel I happen to be watching for those elections, electoral debates, those people in the little chairs being asked questions, I'm like, you people have decided. You just want to be asked to be on national television for, you know, three times in a row for CBS or whatever channel you happen to be participating with.
Well, if you're on a focus group, that may be the case if you get on the Katie Couric show or on Oprah or something like that. But most of these folks, and this is where you get into that Bradley effect we talked about, because some of those, the people who would be susceptible to possible Bradley effect voters are those who are undecided because they don't want to say. But in most cases, they're people who don't want to reveal, either they don't want to reveal their preference just because they don't want to reveal it to a pollster, or they feel that there is some stigma. That could be Bradley effect, reverse Bradley effect. That could be folks who feel that they're going to go against their spouse or against their parents, if you're a younger voter, by voting in a different direction. For whatever reason, these are people who don't feel comfortable. But I would say that the number of folks today who plan to vote on Tuesday and who are truly undecided is not 7 or 8%. It's probably closer to about 1.5%. By all the data that we have, would suggest that it's really below 2% of people who truly, as of today, don't know.
Pete?
I would only go back to, I mean, I would echo everything that Jim had to say. The number probably is lower. But to your question about, you know, how could you be undecided, I mean, certainly there's some percentage of Americans who simply aren't going to be engaged politically. I mean, and that's okay. They can make that choice, despite us living in this universe and really getting into it, as a lot of Americans are.
Then go eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
Right.
But
well,
stop, or say no thanks when someone asks you to be on TV or participate in the poll.
Well, but I also think, going back to a point we made earlier, this dynamic of continuity and change, that makes some people nervous. And I think they genuinely don't know which way they want to go, because there's risk involved. There's a comfort going with a candidate who seems to represent a bit more continuity. There is an appeal there. That's one of the reasons why, as Jim mentioned, Senator McCain is still doing fairly well, given all of these structural advantages that Obama has. So there's a comfort in something that's more tried and true, that is more experienced. And there is, of course, the appeal, the excitement, the allure, particularly given the backdrop of economic downturn, of something new, of change. And so I have no doubt there are a percentage of Americans who are really right on the fence because of the nervousness that that change in continuity dynamic brings out in them. And I think it's real.
All right, I got a caller on the line, but caller, hang tight since it's almost 11:40, 11:39 here on the Wake Up Call. And yes, it's not post-church hour where you should be eating your brunch. You should have moved your clock back 1 hour, 11:39 on the Wake Up Call. And let's do this.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, with the Virginia Film Festival winding down and artistic director Richard Herskowitz about to move on, The Hook suggests 9 different people as possible replacements. The Tough Customer talks about a particular customer's problems with a local auto dealer and tires. And as always, right now, more news on the politics. So, The Hook says, just get out and vote. Let's also thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support. Meade Avenue and East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom T-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. And since you just walked in the studio, let me remind you to hang tight at noon, because Drew Thompson will be here for Les Temps Purdue, the best of 80s and 90s alternative. No Madonna, no Steve Winwood, no Metallica, but you will hear The Wallflowers, Juliana Hatfield, and Pavement. And Drew likes requests. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music. Speaking of requests, we'll take requests here. If you've got a good question, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. And we got Gary. Hey, Gary.
Hey, good morning. Good program. First a comment and then my question, and I'll hang up and just listen to the answer to my question. I'm impressed with the neutrality of your guests, assuming coming from the university work that they might be a little more liberal than others, but I think they've been very fair this morning, with maybe the exception I heard one guest say twice that in the last 8 years we've had an unpopular president. Well, he did win election twice, so he was popular enough to get that, even though I'm sure somebody might argue that the second one was a fix or something, and I'm not a pro-Republican. I just wanted to make that observation. My question is this. I'd like their thoughts on, I guess, what I'm calling geographic demographics. Why is it that this country is so polarized from state to state, whereas an Obama is automatically going to win a Massachusetts and a California, whereas his opponent, McCain, is probably automatically going to win some Midwest, some Southern, and some Western states? I'd just like to have them comment on what's polarizing us as a nation, and I'll just hang up and listen.
Well, that's a great question, and thanks, Gary, for our neutrality. I personally am a fire-breathing, passionate, middle-of-the-roader, so I try to be as careful as possible. In terms of that, that's a great discussion, and there's that could fill 2 or 3 shows that we really don't have as to why we are so polarized. And this certainly came out after the 2000 election in Florida. I'll give you some possible answers that people have suggested. The first is the parties want it that way, that it makes campaigning easier. If you can get a lock, and this began on the Republican side with the so-called Southern strategy that Richard Nixon used in 1968 and 1972, to try to appeal to former Southern Democrats who were bothered by the more liberal drift of the party with the selection of Humphrey and then McGovern, and to sort of create a unifying force, a cultural, religious force in the South that would brand them to the Republican Party, which would be pro-life on the abortion issue, less gun control, less government regulation. And this appealed to a broad spectrum of Southerners because it was very shrewdly designed through an advertising campaign. And the Democrats, conversely, really control the coasts, New York and California particularly, through their media outlets. And it makes campaigning a little bit easier. Another possible view on this is the fact that these, in the political scientist debate, is the degree to which these are real factors. One of the best books that I've read on American politics and would heartily recommend to you and other listeners who might like this question is a book by Thomas Franks called What's the Matter with Kansas? And it came out after the 2004 election. And Franks looks at Kansas as a test case. Why do the Republicans do so well with voters who structurally, by income, tax policy, health care, should be voting with the Democratic Party and are voting Republican? And he sets forth an argument there, which is controversial. There's other people who have written about it, pro and con, to argue that a lot of this is controlled by mass marketing. And the only way that you're going to change it is to change the party structure. And that's why there was debate in the election, and Obama's played on this, and to some extent McCain, as to whether or not Karl Rove, for example, he's used a lot as an example of this, sort of divided the country to appeal to geographic blocks. So that's one answer. And if you're interested in this, look at Franks. You may like it, you may not like it, but it's a very important book. And another one, and this is one that Pete and I were talking about early on, and maybe in the closing minutes we'll look at, is the mathematics of the electoral map. A lot of people who are looking at your questions say, look at the Electoral College. All you have to get is 270 votes. You could lose the popular vote. Al Gore won the popular vote, and all you need to win is 271, and you're the president of the United States. And, for example, Obama right now could lose if you take all the votes that Kerry got in 2004, it's 252, and you add a number of smaller states, including Virginia, that he's likely to win, it's 291. He could lose Ohio, Florida, Missouri, Indiana, and still be president. And that means that appealing to states, cultural forces, social forces within those states, even if you alienate the rest of the country and you only win by the narrowest of margins, means you're still president. So another answer to your question, I don't want to monopolize this time, I know Pete wants to get in here on this because it's an important point, is that our electoral system, not only the parties, also contributes to geographic divisions because, frankly, that's what the Founding Fathers wanted in terms of making the states the determinant of who became president.
Yeah, Jim makes excellent points and really covers, I think, the ground in terms of red and blue. I think two other issues. One is that we do self-select as well. Americans are a lot more mobile now, and for some time, I think people move to states that they perceive are like them and share their values. So that at one level can further emphasize or highlight the red versus blue. But I think to Jim's point as well, I do think it tends to be overstated, actually. I think there is a tendency in the American mindset in the way that electoral competitions are covered, the sort of horse race mentality. We like things to be black and white. We like the you're with us or against us. It's one side or the other. So red and blue appeals to that. Jim and I have joked in other contexts that are more about geopolitics that we really took the Cold War map at the end of the Cold War, which divided the world into either red states or blue states. You're either with us or against us. And when the Cold War ended, we didn't know what to do with that map. And so we applied it here at home, and we start talking about red states and blue states, very simply, because purple or gray confuses us, and it's a level of complexity that makes it harder to decide. So I think we actually are more purple than it appears, and that's going to continue to grow. It's one of the reasons why Senator Obama is having his success. We are more suburban and urban. We are more mixed demographically. We are more educated as a society. So the whole idea of a real America or the real patriots, et cetera, I think those types of appeals will have a narrower and narrower effect because the country is changing so much right in front of our eyes. And so some of the demographic dynamics we've seen taking shape right now are only going to grow. We're talking about a country where in states like Hawaii and Texas and New Mexico and California and others, there is either now or will be in the next 10 years no majority population. They will be minority-majority states. That's indicative of significant change, and that will further bleed red and blue into purple. But an excellent question.
Thanks, Gary, as always. A wonderful question. Dial us up if you want to add to the chatter today, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Jim Sofka, Pete Ronayne here, local area academic experts on the political world as we wind down a, what did we decide it was, 21-month election down to the last 48 hours.
Yes, an odyssey.
100 years war.
Another question over the internet. I'm tired of robocalls every night when I get home.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's not really a question. That was a statement that was made. Again, we can go back to the infomercial that we talked about with Obama. And I know that I've gotten some, and it's been from both sides.
Yeah.
Twice now I've come home, either after work or being gone somewhere, and found that someone has been to my house. And I live in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
So someone has made the...
Someone had your porridge?
Someone has been to my cabin in the woods and has... And that was that took some effort and hung some political sign on my doorknob. And yesterday or Friday or whenever it happened, actually had a piece of information about my voting precinct.
Yep.
Where to go,
yep.
When to be there, you know, what to do or who to call if I had some problem. Are these things... Can they be so bothersome as to turn someone away from their decided candidate or make them decide to not vote at all?
I don't think they have that kind of effect, and I think what's behind it is those robocalls, in my estimation, and Jim might disagree, but they're not about swaying your vote either way. They're about both candidates fighting off complacency amidst the ground troops. You know, I think particularly on Obama's side, he's had a lead for a little while now. The poll numbers haven't changed all that much in the past week and a half. It's, 50-43 or 49-43, something like that. I think they are all about, for both sides, reminding the faithful that the election's coming up and I need your active support. I need you to get out there. Just constant reminders to go out and, like you said, Rick, to go out and vote. So I don't think it's enough to turn people off at this point. But then maybe it just doesn't bother me as much. Jim?
Yeah, I agree. It's exactly what it's about. It's also to try and get people to the polls, because having all the support in the world on polls does nothing if people actually don't go out to vote. But there's people have come about this. There is a growing concern about these robocalls, and there's a website that you can go to on stopping political calls, sort of like the FCC Do Not Call list, which parties can get around because they're not actually selling anything. They're nonprofit institutions. So whether or not that can actually work, there's some arguments that by the time they trickle through to the party high command, they're not going to be able to stop the calls. I agree with Pete. I don't think the robocalls are going to really change things one way or another. They're just part of life in the political season.
All right. A couple quick questions, and then we'll 10 minutes left, we'll jump into some information about the key states, what to watch for on election night. Do newspaper endorsements have the same effect in terms of helping designate a winner as they used to?
No. Newspaper editorial, there's been a lot of literature on this. Newspaper endorsements reach those who read the newspaper, which is itself a changing demographic. More people read online, fewer people, and people who read online are actually less likely to look at the opinion pages than people who look at the print editions of newspapers. And newspaper endorsements, by reaching the readers of those papers, are reaching a targeted demographic. For example, the Wall Street Journal is going to reach a more Republican audience than the New York Times or the Washington Post.
And they're not likely to surprise their readers with their endorsement. It's not going to – if you're a regular reader of one of those papers, you won't be surprised by who they endorse because, it's a self-selected reader.
Yeah, that's not going to change the presidential level. Now, at the local level, there's less data. That is, in congressional races where people feel more tied to their community newspapers, that is how a local daily or weekly would endorse a particular candidate, because those tend to be read by people who are very active in a community. There could be some influence about what the state of play is within the community elites. But I would say that newspaper endorsements are a rapidly declining fact of American political life and have been for the past 20 years. And that's only going to accelerate in every electoral cycle as papers go over more to online.
All right. Let me take a moment and thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for letting us be on air today and having this discussion. Blue Ridge has winter clothing from Patagonia, Mountain Hardware, The North Face, as well as trail shoes from Montrail and Vasque. Blue Ridge staff has over 30 years of experience in keeping you warm and dry in any weather. You'll find Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Berwick Road Shopping Center in Charlottesville, at Wintergreen in Richmond, and at brms.com. All right, guys, I think most people know the key states, and they've already come up in discussion today. There's Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other key states, the ones that are not necessarily overlooked by the pundits, as I think you used the word, but by those who are not necessarily who aren't reading the third and fourth paragraphs in the article, as I like to say. And Virginia is one of those. Mm-hmm. And Pete, you made a mention out in the lobby about if Virginia does this, then you can turn off your TV and go to bed.
That's actually the Jim Sofka bellwether, that if Virginia's called early for Obama,
by at least 5 percentage points, then it's over.
Then it's probably game over. And Virginia will be interesting. I mean, as we know, I mean, when you're talking about a state that's historically has been about the Confederacy and slavery, it's a southern state, and has not gone Democratic for president since LBJ in 64, and it's in play. That is indicative of broader changes. If you're a McCain supporter, you don't like to hear that, but it's true. And Virginia represents some of those other trends we talked about before. I mean, 5 out of 10 Virginians are born out of state now, and 1 out of 10 are from abroad, 70% of them from Latin America or Asia. It is a much more diverse state. So it's very representative of broader trends in the United States. So if Obama claims Virginia, who they might report out fairly early compared to other states tonight, not just because they're on the East Coast, if his 4-point lead holds or expands, yeah, that suggests that it could be a long night. In fact, what we'll look for after that is, I think, if Virginia and North Carolina and then Florida, if they are in the Obama, then it really is going to be a long night, not just for McCain, but for House Republicans and Senate Republicans as well.
Yeah, in response to Gary's call earlier, I said it's all about math. I mean, just consider some of these numbers when you're looking at these battlegrounds. I mean, sure, Florida, Ohio get a lot of attention, but look at it this way. Assuming Obama carries all the states that Kerry did in 2004, that puts him at 252 electoral votes. You need 270 to win. Look at some of these smaller states, Nevada, Colorado. Nevada's got 5 electoral votes. New Mexico has got 5 electoral votes. If Obama wins, as he's likely to, Iowa, Virginia, New Mexico, Colorado, Nevada, even if he wins them by, say, 2 percentage points in the popular vote, he's president. He has 291 electoral votes. He could lose Florida. He can give it away to McCain, Missouri, Ohio. It doesn't matter. He's president of the United States. And just to show you how difficult the headwinds are for McCain, take my wife's beloved Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which is where it's gotten a lot of attention lately. For McCain to win Pennsylvania, based on some polling data that I crunched right before coming over here, he's got to win 95% of Republicans. Okay, that seems logical. 15% of Democrats to siphon off from Obama, and 60 to 65% of independents in Pennsylvania to get him to 51%. The odds of doing that math successfully, that's why he's there so much, he's putting in a heroic effort, it's staggering.
And,
so,
and nationally, Obama leads with independents 51 to 35.
51 to 35,
so
yeah.
That makes it even harder. We were saying out in the lobby before, Obama has a greater chance of winning Arizona than McCain does of winning Pennsylvania at this stage.
So, and for those who aren't fully invested in the topic, Arizona being McCain's home state.
Right. Probably not likely, but it's possible. And it's more possible than McCain picking up Pennsylvania. So it does show, I think it's a good phrase that Jim used, the headwinds are strong. You know, Missouri seems to be tilting a bit more towards McCain.
Yeah, I think McCain
at this point. Indiana's a toss-up.
Why is this race still considered so close? I mean, Gary was polite enough to say that that the two of you have been fairly fair on the topic in terms of representing both sides well, the pros and the cons. It seems to me, at least in the state of Virginia, and possibly it's just the news and the radio that I tend to lean towards, but it's all about you know, the almost the divisiveness, or excuse me, the decisiveness with, mm-hmm. with which Obama is coming down to here in the last few days, and the trouble that McCain is trying to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
How is this happening in terms of McCain still being so much in the race that we are even really talking about how it could happen, how he could, the heroism with which he's still putting forth the effort?
Well,
it seems
well,
to me that it's 70 to 30 almost in terms of Obama.
Well, it is. I mean, I think if Jim and I are, give our actual analysis for the results on Tuesday, we were both lean towards it. It is game over. I mean, I would go on the record as saying that. Now, there are real hypotheticals. We are talking about human behavior here. A human electoral behavior is not subject to regression analysis, et cetera. It can vary. But the winds are pointing towards certainly what I would consider a significant electoral margin, if not a beatdown, really, by Obama over McCain. There are local and regional races that are close, but overall it's not going to be that close if things go the way that we expect. Now, there's always the Truman-Dewey scenario, and certainly that's what McCain is hoping for at this stage, but it doesn't look good at all.
All right, yeah. Let me do this real quick, and I got one question to finish up here. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetfire Amherst Lynchburg. The last 60 seconds or so with Jim Sofka and Pete Ronain, both from the Federal Executive Institute, as we talk about politics for Tuesday's election. Perriello and Virgil Goode, mm-hmm. because we talked about Obama's money being spent to help some of the other elections, et cetera. What's going to happen there?
Goode's going to win. I think Perriello has done very well because the Virginia 5th District has been identified by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee as a red to blue district. That is, they're going to invest a lot more money than they have in the past to make an attempt to wrest it from the Republicans. And they've done quite well. Perriello has gotten a fair amount of money to produce high quality political ads and mailings. And, right, you know, to think about it this way, at the end of August, Goode was ahead by 34 points. And my prediction is he'll win it by probably 6 on Tuesday. I mean, we can quibble about those numbers. Some say 7. I've seen it spread anywhere from 7 to 13. I'd say 6, just, you know, because I'll put that out as a prognostication.
Middle of the road.
All right. Well, we got to finish up. Thanks to both of you for coming on today.
Sure.
Have your wonderful electoral night parties for those of you who will be attending. The key factor being be able to go to your party with your I voted sticker on your shirt. Thank you so much for everyone. Next Sunday, we will be having some teenagers in here, artistically profound, musically profound, theatrically profound. Please join in next time.
Wake Up Call on WNRN. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Michael Strickland. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.